Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Pooja Goyal, Chief Investment Officer of the Infrastructure Group here at Carlyle, as well as co-head of Carlyle Global Infrastructure Opportunity Fund and head of the Renewable and Sustainable Energy Fund. We'll discuss several topics in the infrastructure space, including the impact of AI, the energy transition, and the evolution of infrastructure investments. So thank you for joining us, Pooja.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
This episode was recorded on February 4th, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before I turn to Pooja, just a few words about some of the big stories in the macroeconomy over the past few weeks. First, it seems the U.S. economy dodged a bit of a bullet this past Monday when the Trump administration decided to postpone for 30 days tariffs that were going to be imposed on Canada and Mexico. I thought that this experience, the way it was covered, the way it was discussed, really revealed the extent to which the salience of inflation during the 2024 campaign has really distorted our perspective of what was likely to happen here. And so when you think about the actual proposal that was signed, again, before it was later postponed, it was going to cover 44% of U.S. imports. So imports from Canada, Mexico, and China. The blended increase in the effective tariff rate on imports coming to the United States would have been 18 percentage points. So when you look at essentially almost 6% of U.S. GDP and spending subjected to an 18 percentage point rate increase, you had what was effectively a tax increase of 1% of GDP. For comparison's sake, the 2017 tax cuts, the provisions that expire at the end of 2025, if they're not extended, that would result in a tax increase of about 1.3% of GDP. So actually, you know, quite comparable in the economic impact. And yet, instead of worrying about how the economy might respond to this shock, most of the discussion was about things like a potential increase in the price of avocados and the effect on inflation and the effect on perhaps the Fed keeping rates higher as a result. But I think were it not for the focus on inflation, given the recent history, most analysis would suggest that this sort of one-time price shock would have actually made Fed cuts more likely, because the potential impact would have been to slow spending, potentially increase the unemployment rate, and just generally lead to an economy where most indicators are performing less well than prior to the onset of the shock, making, again, somewhat easier policy more likely. And in fact, we saw this in Japan in 2014. There was a 3 percentage point increase in the consumption tax. So yes, that led to a roughly 3 percentage point increase in the Japanese CPI. But that one-time price shock then led to a significant deceleration in spending, economic growth, and actually led to Bank of Japan policy that was even easier than it would otherwise have been, with more asset purchases. So we'll see what happens over the next 30 days, how the negotiations go. I think there's a hope, general expectation even, that tariffs will be postponed indefinitely. But there's also questions about what happens with the EU and those negotiations and potential tariffs there. So it's going to be a very exciting 2025. Again, I just think macro investors should think more about the output loss and some of the short-term balance of risks in that direction rather than, again, this almost monomaniacal focus on inflation. One other issue I wanted to discuss, and that will lead into our discussion with Pooja, is the economic outperformance we've seen in the U.S. Last week, the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis reported that the U.S. economy expanded at a 2.3% annualized rate in the fourth quarter of 2024. This is the eighth consecutive quarter that U.S. GDP growth has exceeded prior year consensus forecasts. And on average, the outperformance has been about 1.5% of GDP. So this is actually the largest and most sustained period of economic outperformance we've seen in some time. And much of this is actually attributable to the extraordinary growth in AI-related CapEx. And I think the outlook here has become less certain, one could say. On January 20th, a little-known AI lab based in China called DeepSeek released an open-source model that purported to have roughly the same performance as well-known, most used large language models at a small fraction of the cost. And there's a lot of questions about what was included in that cost estimate, but there does seem to be, you know, some genuine innovations here, at least as it relates to the cost of inference or the runtime using chatting with the model. And this has raised questions about the future of CapEx. I think many people see that this suggests that actually the capital that the GPU's computing capacity has actually become more productive or is likely to become more productive as a result. That means that the return on investment is actually higher, which means that we're likely to see more CapEx, more spending, and acceleration in demand for GPUs and computing capacity. However, it does also raise questions about market structure. You know, if you think about the entry cost for the market for generative foundational AI models, I think many people have started to think that the entry cost is effectively $100 billion. That's what's required to compete in this space. So, and if that's true, of course, it's likely to be a market that does not involve many players, given the scale of those upfront costs. This, I think, raises the possibility that it actually ends up being a much more competitive market with entry costs that are perhaps somewhat lower than people had thought. And I think that has interesting implications for business strategy, particularly for some of those incumbents or first movers, one should say, that moved into the market and had spent quite a lot of sums, again, perhaps with expectations of a market that was a bit more concentrated than it may ultimately prove to be. And so, Pooja, I'm looking forward to discussing your outlook for AI and the implications for the investment environment. But before we start talking about that, I just wanted you to describe your role as CIO of Carlyle's infrastructure group and what you're focused on in today's environment.
Sure. And again, Jason, thank you for inviting me on your podcast. So I am Chief Investment Officer of our infrastructure platform at Carlyle, where I oversee all investing activity, starting from origination, underwriting, value creation, all the way through to exit, across two strategies that we manage within the platform. And I would say about 75% of our portfolio is right here in the United States. And we primarily invest in four sectors: transport and logistics, digital infrastructure, and I know that's going to be a big topic of discussion today, just given your introduction, energy midstream, and then power and renewables, again, in OECD markets, where we've had investments right here in the United States, in Western Europe, and Japan, and Australia. I work in partnership with my partner, Pete Taylor, as well as with the other MDs and partners in the business. I would say strategically, this is a very important asset class for Carlyle. Our strategy within our infrastructure platform at Carlyle is to primarily focus on companies or platforms that have a very strong asset orientation to them. So we don't really invest in companies that are asset light or services oriented. We tend to focus on a more traditional definition of infrastructure. And then we invest in those assets with a view towards limiting our downside and working towards creating optionality on our upside. Just given some of the thematics that you mentioned around AI, adjacent opportunities associated with AI, and then opportunities associated with the energy transition more broadly.
And so let's just focus for a moment on AI-related infrastructure, the exponential growth. There's no forecast that doesn't have exponential growth in investment in hardware, things like GPUs, the infrastructure, the physical assets, data centers, related applications. It's just a question of how rapid this is likely to be. As an investor, how are you approaching this? How are you thinking about the dynamic market that seems to change on a daily basis?
I think, look, your comments on forecasts, you know, you as an investor, I got to tell you, you know, we obviously rely on market-driven forecasts. There are some fantastic consultants and advisors out there that have very robust data sets. We rely on that. But, you know, the forecasts are a little all over the place. some forecasts tend to be very aggressive. And we are also noticing that there's a real discrepancy in forecasting methodology, especially for AI-related infrastructure, let's say in the United States versus Western Europe. So I'll give you specific examples around that. But look, you know, just to share some statistics with you, and this is more looking back versus looking forward, but according to IBM, 90% of the world's data was really created in the last 2 years. And if you look at the global data center market, it was estimated at right around 33 gigawatts in 2023. Now, talking about forecasts, it is projected to reach about 100 gigawatts by 2030. And I have to tell you, as an investor in infrastructure, you know, typically we're used to seeing growth rates that are in line with GDP. So you're talking about growth rates for the sectors that we focus on that are typically in the single digits, mid to high single digits at best. So all of a sudden, you're seeing a very capital-intensive, asset-driven asset class or sector where the growth rates that you're talking about are CAGRs of, you know, 20% plus. And that's creating some very interesting dynamics around capital allocation and also capital formation. Now, for AI-related infrastructure, broadly speaking, you can divide it into two categories. And you touched on both the categories in your introduction. You have GPUs, which is the chips and the racks. And then you have the power that's needed for these data centers. Now, as an infrastructure investor, I'm going to focus more on the power side of the equation versus the GPU side of the equation, because that tends to be more of a tech-driven, manufacturing-oriented business. On the power side of the equation, depending on how you build your data center, about 50% of the capital expenditure, as well as 50% of the OPEX associated with operating a data center, tends to be power. Power is a significant constraining factor right now for any of these forecasts to materialize. And when I'm talking about power, I'm not just talking about the availability of power. So let's say generation capacity. I'm also talking about transmission distribution capacity. And that has been a key bottleneck that is very difficult to resolve. Not all of those bottlenecks are simply solved with the availability of capital. In some instances, that does require quite significant policy initiatives as well around upgrading your transmission distribution infrastructure, building new transmission distribution infrastructure, as well as permitting requirements. But, you know, if you take an example of right here in the United States for Texas, load today in Texas is 86 gigawatts. The forecasted load for Texas in 2028, so 3 years from now, is supposed to be 137 gigawatts. That is a greater than 50% increase. And that is going to require significant amount of capital expenditure and significant amount of public-private partnership in order for it to materialize. So when we think about investing in all of this growth towards AI-related infrastructure, you know, we tend to focus more on where we have an edge. And our most significant edge right now within our infrastructure business is our deep sector expertise on power. We understand how power markets work. We understand how to develop, bring new power generation capacity online. And we also understand the constraints around transmission distribution infrastructure and how they impact power generation capacity. We currently have over 20 gigawatts of power generation capacity that is in development in the United States. And this is a combination of not just renewable energy capacity, so solar, battery storage, as well as wind, but also thermal power generation capacity, which is primarily through combined cycle. And we are using our expertise in power generation markets to create unique development opportunities around data centers, either to provide powered land or powered shell solutions to hyperscalers that are looking to build these large-scale data centers. So our focus when it comes to AI-related infrastructure is to focus more upstream in the value chain, which is really bringing power generation solutions to the market, which we believe is a bottleneck that can be solved not just with capital, but requires a significant amount of industry expertise as well.
Picking up on the AI theme, but thinking about it in terms of mobility, I was in China in December, and it was interesting to me the extent to which they are really focused on accelerating the advancements in what we call autonomous vehicles, what they call EIVs, electric intelligent vehicles. Of course, this is very much dependent on the inference from AI systems. At the same time, we seem to be moving perhaps in a different direction in the United States, that the EV mandates or efforts to accelerate the transition towards electrified mobility seems to, again, be going in the opposite direction, perhaps. Are we at risk of perhaps falling behind China, given the difference in the policy orientations here?
It's an interesting question that you bring up, Jason. And even when I have spoken to Chinese investors or to any of the OEMs that are pretty heavily involved in the space, and, you know, they've shown me some of the apps that they have for the electric vehicles that they currently own. These EIVs don't just focus on autonomous driving, but they tend to be fairly integrated even with an individual or a homeowner's energy consumption. So I think the AI-related implications are actually just much broader than just autonomous driving as well. I think the amount of data that you're gathering with someone's driving patterns, when and where they park, when and when they get home, how do they use the energy when they get home in terms of their home appliances or their other energy needs. There are a lot of data-driven energy usage patterns that can be derived from these EIVs. So I believe that broadly speaking, it just goes to demonstrate how software can impact user experience. And if you have the right software and integration, it can create a moat around a hardware business. In a way, you could argue that's not too dissimilar from what we've seen companies like Apple do, where, you know, they create an ecosystem where the switching costs for a consumer can be very high. So that's broadly speaking my reaction to EIVs. On electric vehicles specifically, look, all of the batteries that go into electric vehicles are currently made in China. The cells for these battery packs are made in China. So China has made a very strategic decision to be very focused on bringing down the costs of not just electric vehicles, but also these battery packs. As it relates to electric vehicles in the United States, look, the focus, especially if you look at the most recent executive orders, the focus has been that Americans should be in a position to decide what kind of vehicle they want to drive. And so the focus has been on repealing this EV mandate, which is taking away the tax credit that is available for electric vehicles in a bid to make sure that internal combustion engines are not unfairly uncompetitive when compared to electric vehicle when someone's making a decision as to which car to buy or not. So I do believe that it's more about consumer choice there and competition versus anything else. But yes, China has made a very strategic decision to bring down the cost of electric vehicles. And with EIVs, it's just a broader application of AI.
So the changed policy circumstance, I think, has also changed, I think, decarbonization initiatives, perhaps. I'd be interested in your view on that. But I want to also focus specifically on carbon capture, sequestration, and the potential role that they can play, again, given a policy mix that perhaps may be a bit more favorable to traditional energy sources.
So again, I think it's very important to pay attention very closely to what is actually included in these executive orders and also how they could translate into actual policy that's implemented. The focus is definitely on making the US an energy major, increasing the production of molecules as well as electrons in the United States. And ultimately, with a view towards making the United States a net exporter of energy. So the view would be that if these orders are actually implemented into policy, you should see a lot more activity in the energy sector in the US. So that would include, let's say, upstream drilling activity and potentially new investment going into downstream applications as well. So LNG-related development opportunities or other opportunities around molecules or electrons could suddenly become very important and very viable. Our infrastructure business focuses on investing capital in the midstream business, We're not an energy private equity strategy, so we don't focus on upstream or downstream opportunities. We focus more on midstream, which is the physical assets that facilitate the flow of hydrocarbons. So in the case of molecules, it would be pipelines, storage terminals, tanks. In the case of electrons, it would be transmission distribution infrastructure. So any sort of increase in volume makes your existing assets more valuable, because there is just simply going to be more throughput out of your existing assets. Or any increase in volume means that there's going to be more need for midstream infrastructure on carbon capture and sequestration and storage. Look, the point that I'll make for you, and I'll tie it back to what you said even about AI-related infrastructure, you're going to need more power. And that power is going to come from a diversity of fuel mix. We do expect thermal power to be a very important part of that equation. And so if you are going to be building combined cycle capacity, and there are incentives available that enable carbon capture and sequestration, I do believe that will continue to be a very important part of any investor's portfolio, which is opportunities around carbon capture and sequestration. Remember, as private market investors, we have to be able to de-risk our investments, even in terms of the exit value or residual value assumption. So while energy transition today or decarbonization today might be less of an emphasis, if you want to de-risk your exit value assumption, you will want to make sure that you have the ability to flex either way.
Yeah, and just the midstream, it's really volumetric. There's no price risk there. Is that the best way to think about the risk to which you're exposed?
I would say as infrastructure investors, we're very mindful that investors are allocating capital to us from their infrastructure bucket and not their energy private equity bucket. Mm-hmm. So not just for midstream, but even on power or renewables, we tend to make sure that our assets are contracted. At least a base level of contracts are in place before we spend the capex to build those assets. So you're right, for midstream assets, for example, we would want to make sure that we have a certain amount of contracts that are in place that generate enough of a cash yield to support our investment thesis. So we prefer to avoid taking a significant amount of commodity price exposure, and in some instances, even volume risk, to make sure that we're appropriately downside protected.
Great. Well, while I have you, I do want to ask about one of the most high-profile Carlyle investments of the past decade, really, which has been the redevelopment, the transformation of JFK. Just tell us how that's proceeding. And also, if you could just give us a sense of how that fits in with some of the themes that we've discussed today.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought it up, Jason, because, you know, in all that excitement about digital infrastructure and power and energy, oftentimes, people miss out on what is a significant investing opportunity in the US, which is just around core infrastructure, which is our airports, ports, and other areas. And, you know, I will tell you, US airport infrastructure needs alone are projected to grow by 31% over the next 5 years. You're talking about requiring over $150 billion of capital over the next 5 years in order to meet infrastructure needs. And this is just in the United States alone. Our team has led the development of 19 different airports. That is how much expertise sits within the team. And JFK is really a case study for how private capital can partner with public stakeholders, because that is how airports are redeveloped in the United States and really deliver transformative outcomes from an economic perspective, as well as the right outcome for our partners that are public market stakeholders. So JFK was a transaction that we started working on in 2018, and we worked very closely with the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, with labor unions, local communities, airlines, construction companies, and last but not the least, our financing partners to deliver a redeveloped terminal for JFK Airport. Now, if we started working on it in 2018 and the terminal is currently under construction, we did work through this project even during the pandemic. In fact, in March of 2020, we were about to reach financial close on this project when COVID hit and the skies shut down. At that point in time, we decided to be committed to what we had promised to deliver to our partners. We worked hand in hand with our partners to recut the transaction figure out a development path for the terminal that would be viable, assuming lower passenger volumes, as well as delayed traffic patterns because of the pandemic. And I'm happy to report that in 2023, we did reach financial close on redevelopment of JFK New Terminal 1. The project is currently on schedule, and we expect to welcome passengers in June of 2026 through the new terminal. So it's just a fantastic example of how our sector expertise in airports, a captive platform that we own called Carlyle Airport Group Holdings, where we have executives who worked at airports as well as airlines previously, we were all able to come together and really deliver the right outcome, both for our investors as well as our partners in that case.
Well, Pooja, thank you so much for joining me today. I really learned quite a lot.
Thanks, Jason. Lots to come from our infrastructure business.
Very exciting. As always, thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next month for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.